So you're listening to Biotech Hangout, a weekly discussion of the latest biotech news. I'm Brad Loncar, and my co-hosts today are Don Bell, Yaron Werber, Tim Oppler, and Josh Schimmer. And we'll get right into this. This is going to be one of those weeks where we're in like the mainstream news big time because the American Heart Association annual meeting is going on. And the big headline, of course, is going to be Wegovy. We already know that it hit on cardiovascular outcomes. It lowered the chance of like hospitalization or death, or like heart attacks by 20%. But I think everyone's looking to see, sometimes the devil is in the details. But I'm going to kick it over to Don to give us a more formal introduction to the conference and some of the things that are going on. Don?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Brad. So this is actually going to be my first AHA this decade. As some of you know, I've been in cardiovascular medicine most of my 30-year career, and I was really excited to be going through the late-breaking abstracts, getting ready for it this week, because we have been through some deserts of data in cardiovascular medicine, and this is definitely not one of those deserts. It was a smorgasbord of, and I noticed this trend of all of these interesting biologics. So certainly the headliner, the biggest buzz is likely to be the semaglutide outcomes data. I think you nailed it, Brad. I mean, this is an important landmark trial. It's 17,000 patients with established cardiovascular disease who are overweight or obese. And the primary endpoint, again, is that composite of major adverse cardiovascular events, which is cardiovascular death, non-fatal heart attacks, and non-fatal strokes. And what will be interesting to see is how each of those contributed to the primary endpoint. If any of them, have a statistically significant impact alone, probably not powered for that, would be interesting to see. And I'm really interested in the absolute risk reduction. This is a pretty high-risk patient group, so you would expect the baseline risk in the control group to be fairly high. But it's that absolute risk reduction that's really going to drive economic calculations for payers, et cetera. And so I'm really, really curious to see the details of this. So I wanted to tell everyone about like this biologics revolution, because this is a field that has been historically dominated by small molecule therapeutics or devices as well. But we're really seeing a lot of really interesting biologics, certainly, semaglutide being one of them. But another exciting news, Verve Therapeutics will present its phase 1b data of VERVE-101, which is an in vivo DNA base editing medicine that inactivates PCSK9. Now, PCSK9, I'm sure many of you know, is a well-validated target to lower LDL cholesterol. And there are three approved therapies that do that. So two monoclonal antibodies, one from Amgen, one from Regeneron. And then the latest is an siRNA product being launched by Novartis, which originated at Alnylam and was acquired by Novartis when they bought the medicines company. So this base editing medicine study is a single ascending dose. They're looking mostly at safety and tolerability, but we'll have some interesting efficacy pharmacodynamic markers in the study. It's going to be done in heterozygous familial hyperlipidemia patients who have cardiovascular disease and whose LDL cholesterol is uncontrolled on oral therapies like statins. So pretty high-risk cohort of patients. And so we'll understand, how this base editing was able to reduce PCSK9 protein levels and LDL cholesterol, as well as get some initial safety data across four cohorts. So that's really historic, and I'm really excited to see that data from Verve. Sticking with the lipid theme and these kind of advanced biologics, so Lilly will also be presenting safety and efficacy data for I'm going to butcher some of these names. Lepodisiran, which is their siRNA targeting lipoprotein little A. They in-licensed this from Dicerna. Now, lipoprotein little A is a form of bad cholesterol that's highly associated with cardiovascular disease, and there are no effective approved drugs for lipoprotein little A. Now, this is a really hot field. Novartis is developing pelacarsen for this, which is an ASO from Ionis. Amgen also has an siRNA, olpasiran, under development for lipoprotein little a that they brought in from Arrowhead. And then Silence is running a phase two trial for their siRNA, which should complete enrollment this quarter. So hopefully in the coming quarters, we'll have some an embarrassment of riches, if you will, go from zero to maybe perhaps, three or four in patients with lipoprotein little a. So that's a really exciting field to watch. And then moving from lipids to another critical modifiable risk factor with enormous unmet need is hypertension. Now, it may sound strange that for a condition with as many different medicines and different mechanisms approved, as is the case for hypertension, that there is still a lot of unmet need. But indeed, that is the case. Recent epidemiological data indicate that we are actually losing ground on blood pressure control. And unclear exactly why that is, but certainly, environmental factors, the increasing obesity rates, and probably, not to be discounted, challenges in initiating and titrating complicated multi-drug regimens, in a healthcare system that really isn't fit for purpose for complex care, and some in many cases that could be leading to this loss of control, if you will, of blood pressure population control in the population. And so drug makers are responding to this unmet need by introducing long-acting, highly effective biologics. And so I find this really fascinating. We're going to see KARDIA-1data. So that is a phase two study with Alnylam's siRNA zilebesiran. That's tomorrow afternoon. So this study enrolled, phase two study again, enrolled nearly 400 patients with mild to moderate hypertension on one of five dosing arms. And they're looking at change in systolic blood pressure at 3 months. And they are looking at a Q3-month and a Q6-month regimen here with different doses. So we did see top-line data back in September, which showed highly efficacious results. So a placebo-subtracted reduction of 15 millimeters of mercury. That's a lot. At the higher doses. And so we really look forward to understanding that data better, how long, this effect is lasting, any, the side effects that we might be seeing with this type of therapy. That's going to be super interesting. And then sticking with hypertension, both Regeneron and Novartis are presenting first-in-human data with their monoclonal antibodies that are agonist of the NPR1 receptor. Now, NPR1 is the natriuretic peptide receptor. Natriuretic peptides, atrial natriuretic peptide, brain natriuretic peptide are endogenous substrates for this receptor and well known to have a regulatory role in blood pressure and metabolism. So we'll be excited to see what those first-in-human results show us. I think both of those are looking at, Regeneron's, I think, a weekly administration right now, and Novartis is a monthly administration with those agonists, if I remember well. And if that weren't enough, the full data set for AZALEA-TIMI-71 will be presented on Sunday. And that is looking at Anthos's novel Factor XIa inhibitor, abelacimab. And so abelacimab is a fully human monoclonal antibody against Factor XIa, is dosed once monthly. It's being compared against once-daily oral administration of rivaroxaban, which is, I think, pretty much probably most people know Xarelto. It's a small molecule Factor Xa inhibitor and, on the IRA hit list as one of the highest expenditures for Medicare Part D. And this study was stopped back in December by the Data Safety Monitoring Board for overwhelming safety advantage, which was the primary endpoint, compared to rivaroxaban. And what will be interesting to learn here is if there was any trade-off in efficacy with the trial. The study is looking at patients with atrial fibrillation to prevent stroke. That I'm really excited to hear about that. That drug was actually spun out of Novartis and into Anthos with backing from private equity. So that'll be super interesting. So fully seven late-breaking data sets of new biological medicines at arguably the world's most impactful cardiology scientific meeting. And I'm hoping that this wave of positive biologic data, is a hallmark for a new era of innovation, against the world's number one killer. And we tend to be quite focused on rare diseases and oncology and biotech. I think that those development programs are sort of well suited to the economics of venture-backed biotech. But let's not forget that there is still a lot of innovation needed in cardiovascular medicine, which is still the world's number one killer. So, very excited to be attending my first American Heart in about 5 years down in Philadelphia.
Thanks, Don. Josh, I think you wanted to comment on Bridge. They're going to present some more data from acoramidis and TTR cardiomyopathy.
Yeah, so more going on in the cardiovascular space. Don, that was a great overview. It's nice to see this field starting to come to life. There was really only a trickle of innovation, it felt like, for the past decade or so. And now, you know, to your point, this is like one of the biggest unmet medical needs. So great to see the momentum in the field. One other thing we're watching for is Bridge Bio is going to have another data cut of their phase 3 data for acoramidis for TTR cardiomyopathy. It's kind of, we're positioning for kind of a four-way battle royale between two TTR stabilizers, acoramidis and Pfizer's tafamidis, versus the knockdown agents coming from Alnylam as well as Ionis and Astra. The Ionis-Astra data doesn't come until 2025. Alnylam will give us their data set early next year. Everyone's jockeying for position. I think Bridge has made a very good case that they have a more potent stabilizer than tafamidis. The challenge is that the tafamidis trials were run so long ago that it's making it very hard to get an apples to apples cross trial comparison. But despite that, I think there are still some convincing signals that Bridge Bio has been able to make and will continue to make. And this weekend they're going to show us some time to event analysis. And again, I'm sure looking to facilitate that challenging cross trial comparison, but to still make a case for some advantages over tafamidis in what is already like a $4 billion market, growing at close to a 50% CAGR. So on its way to easily being a $10 billion TAM, if not 15, or potentially even more. And so in theory, there's plenty of room to have multiple solutions for patients. But I think what we're starting to see now is everyone really trying to position their data as best in class to try to dislodge or at least gain a toehold in this important unmet need compared to Pfizer.
I've seen a million TV commercials for Pfizer lately. It's not a branded commercial. It's one of those, like, if you to learn more about TTRCM, you know, go to this website, but definitely Pfizer. Yaron, I know that you followed this space too. Did you want to add anything, or do we have it all covered?
Yeah. I mean, is it just me, or when you watch TV, all you see are commercials for drugs, and we've cured pretty much everything already, right?
For sure. Yeah.
I think we're all seeing that. Yeah.
Especially during the nightly news, like it's like every single commercial during the nightly news is a drug commercial.
And during sports events, right? Like obesity and like a ton of diabetes. Anyway, so a couple of observations after both Don and Josh did a really, really nice job. With AstraZeneca and Ionis, so their study for their ASO, you know, for TTR, that's 1,400 patients. So they, remember, it was supposed to be 750. They decided before they finished enrollment to go to 1,000 and then very quickly decided to go to 1,400. And that the data for that's eplontersen. Eplontersen is not quite as good as Amvuttra, which is Alnylam's drug, in terms of speed of onset to trough TTR. It's also dosed monthly versus Q3 months with Amvuttra. But the nice thing that they did is they massively overpowered the study to be able to look at outcomes if outcomes are happening slower than expected, and look at the contribution for tafamidis alone versus tafamidis with eplontersen. So that's will be interesting to see what's going to happen with ILIOS-B next year. If it hits, that's the Alnylam data, then Ionis and AstraZeneca can probably pull their data forward from H125 to probably H224 because it's big enough. And if ILIOS-B just misses, then they'll probably just let their own study run to fruition, and then they'll probably be well positioned to really potentially get a positive data. The one other thing I just wanted to supplement, Don did a great job talking about the environment with Lp(a). One thing that's going to be interesting, there's actually three important data sets for Lp(a), which recall in Europe, it's considered a risk factor for cardiovascular disease, regardless of LDL, and it's actually on the guidelines to check it. In the US, it's actually not on the guidelines. There are great drugs, as you've noted now, both the ASO from Novartis and Ionis, That's going to have data in the first half of 25. There's olpasiran from Amgen and Arrowhead. That's probably going to have data from a smaller study, but a higher risk. That's going to be first half of 27. And obviously, there's going to be silence that's a little bit behind. And now you have Lilly with Dicerna. But what's going to be at AHN, it's important, is to actually validate whether Lp(a) is a good risk barometer. And there's three sets of data. And the bottom line, number one, it does show that Lp(a) is variable over time, so you have to measure it more than once. That wasn't expected beforehand. And that two, it is now shown to be an independent risk factor in the MGH registry in about 17,000 patients, regardless whether you've already had a cardiovascular event or not, and suggesting that it really could have a role both in primary, you know, preventing the first sort of event or secondary prevention. So that's actually, I believe, some of the first data that's now validating that as a target, you know, before we actually get all these phase threes.
Great. I have a couple questions for the group. Anybody's welcome to jump in and answer them. And the first one is going back to Wegovy, and you know, obviously this was a huge week for the weight loss space with Lilly getting its approval officially this week as well. You know, the up to this point, private insurers and the government haven't really been reimbursing these drugs for weight loss. And my question for the group is, obviously, when you have a landmark cardiovascular outcome study like this, that seems to show like significant benefit, it's going to be harder for payers to turn these down. Is that the significance of this weekend for those drugs? And do you agree that that's the kind of the crux of this data, is that it's going to officially push, you know, payers over the fence? Or is this still going to be a battle, you know, if this turns into the huge category that we think it's going to be? Are payers still going to figure out a way to push back?
Brad, I think it's going to be still tough to achieve that kind of reimbursement. And there's a number of reasons for it. The principal one is cost. But in addition to that, you know, I think we want to see sort of lasting weight loss reduction and sort of lasting effects on patients. In other words, are these a chronic drug that you need to take forever, like your statin, or is there a way to get the benefits with a couple years of treatment? In addition to that, you know, what's critical is to get this, you know, through some type of U.S. government reimbursement process. And at the moment, HHS is literally blocked from reimbursing these drugs. And so I think for commercial insurance to pick up that reimbursement is difficult. On the other hand, the private pay market is just exploding right now. You saw Lilly's numbers, what was last week? I mean, they're unbelievably strong, and Novo's right there too. And so I do think that this epi data will be impactful on how consumers self-pay for these drugs. Ultimately, I do think that there's going to be a very big market.
And Tim, Brad, that you know, this is secondary cardiovascular risk reduction, so it's not primary. I think that you have a lot of overlap with the patients who are getting good access, like diabetics, that you're seeing this in this data set as well. So it'd be interesting to, you know, really drill down on the demographics of the types of patients enrolled here and what other risk factors there are.
What does that mean, secondary benefit?
They already have cardiovascular disease, right? So they've already had a heart attack, or they've already had an angioplasty or bypass surgery. So they have established disease, making them higher risk. So it's not like, you know, the 45-year-old who, you know, wants to lose some weight and, you know, doesn't have diabetes. That's a very different value proposition, if you will, for a payer than someone who already has cardiovascular disease and are very high risk of having a subsequent event, and then this lowering events on top of that.
Got it. And then, Tim, you know, something you said actually leads to my second question. I interviewed Eric Topol last week at Scripps, and, you know, like everyone, he was in agreement that these are, you know, maybe the biggest impact in medicine in decades, if not a lifetime. But he also, like, laid a lot of blame on the companies saying they are doing what kind of what you said, like, will this be chronic or not? He said that the companies are doing nothing to really understand that and try to learn how to get patients off these drugs. And, you know, he did bring up a few things, like a lot of patients do, people who are on these drugs see like an elevated resting heart rate and things. And there's a lot of unknowns when you think about it potentially being a chronic drug. And so I'm just wondering, from the Tim or the group, do you think that's a fair criticism of like Novo and Lilly and the others, that they're really not, you know, working as hard as they could be on figuring out how to wean people off these drugs for, you know, obvious reasons?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, Novo in particular has been doing a lot to pull, you know, claims data. So there's, you know, claims data now like liraglutide going back almost a decade. And really the long-term safety looks very good. The issue is, you know, the time of administration. And the reality is that most people, after they go off these drugs, will put on a lot of the weight back. So, you know, if you're an insurer, that's a major issue. And effectively what it means is you've got to reimburse someone like this stuff's a statin. And then all of a sudden you're saying, okay, it's $1,000 a month. Okay, I'm getting a 50% discount as the insurance company. So I'm going to spend, you know, $100,000 on this patient over the next 15 years. Is that a good investment given what Don's talking about, which is all the risk reduction and so on? And, you know, how else could I spend money on this patient? So I think as the cost of these drugs come down, you'll see things change. Novo and Lilly, of course, are acutely aware of all of this, and they've been making the right moves. So you'll see that both companies are developing orals. Novo went out and bought a company with a small molecule drug. So they're getting ready for a day where they can shift from a drug that involves, you know, an auto injector and expensive to manufacture peptide in a period of manufacturing shortage to a more classic small molecule.
Tim, I agree. And I what I've seen from talking to some of the folks involved in earlier research with these medicines is that they are absolutely acutely trying to understand better these mechanisms of obesity. And one of the things that we think happens is that when you come off of a GLP-1, you have an even increased appetite, like you go back to higher than your baseline appetite. It's sort of like a reactive hyperphagia. And so, you know, we need to figure out weaning regimens and other regimens with the orals. I think everyone's seen that coming. I mean, you might have seen the news too. AstraZeneca just picked up an oral GLP-1 this week as well. So it may not look like it whenever, you know, it was, they're launching these injectable medicines, but I do think, you know, that scientists are thinking hard about these questions and trying to figure out more sustainable regimens for these patients.
To put in a plug for our absent co-host today, Daphne Zohar, she's been a principal in a company that has a drug called Plenity, which is vastly less expensive. Not as effective. It has a very similar effect. It just makes you feel very full. And she's been saying to me, like, you know, maybe a drug like this is what could be used for a maintenance regimen after someone goes off a drug like that. So I do think we're going to see a lot of options popping up, you know, in the months and years ahead.
And then lastly, I mean, this is such a big conference. It's good to spend, you know, this much time on it. Don or anyone, I want to throw out, like, I think the Verve data is going to be fascinating. And I'm just wondering big picture here, like, obviously with like every new technology, you start like in a very severe indication that's a little nichey. So in this case, you know, appropriately, these are patients with severe hypercholesterolemia. And we're just talking about literally single digit people. But I'm wondering if you all could, like, you know, look into the future 5 or 10 years. Is something like a gene therapy, like, could something like that eventually be as like broadly used as like a weight loss drug? Will gene therapy type things get there one day, do you think?
That's a great question, Brad. You know, my gut instinct is that it's in just looking at precedents that we're seeing where they're, you know, gene therapies coming into markets where they're effective, other effective modalities, it's difficult for them to get traction. I think it's going to depend on the COGS and the, you know, the ultimate price that they could offer, you know, sustainably offer these therapies. And of course, the safety. I think that's kind of still an unknown for me.
All right. Well, let's press on. We actually have a couple more conferences to talk about. And I'm going to kick it over to Josh. So, Josh, you have some CAR T to talk about. And amazingly, it's not even an oncology conference. It's a sign of the time. So this is the American College of Rheumatology meeting in San Diego. Tell us about what you're looking forward to.
Yeah, so this is one of the first times we're going to see a collection of data sets for CAR T in autoimmune diseases. Some of the early reports from this technology, and we've talked about this on prior sessions, has been just jaw-droppingly phenomenally good. Like you're seeing lupus disease essentially melt away. The antibodies go away. The patients experience near full recovery, and the effect seems to be durable, and it even seems to be a little bit better tolerated than what we've seen in the oncology setting, possibly for a variety of reasons, but that is going to be important to see sustained, to move into these more chronic type disease settings. We'll also get some data, not just in lupus from a few companies, including Novartis. We'll also have some data updates from myositis and scleroderma. And it's already starting to get tremendous traction, both amongst pharmaceutical companies and rheumatologists who are very eager to see something potentially transformational come their way for patients. Beyond that, it's kind of a bit of a boring rheumatology conference, little dribs and drabs of data. J&J is going to have some rheumatoid arthritis data for the FcRn antibody that looks okay. I'm not sure where it's going to fit in what's kind of a bit of a crowded rheumatoid arthritis landscape with more effective drugs. But yeah, I think for that and some other minor updates, really mean the focal point for the conference is going to be the CAR-T updates.
Awesome.
Quick question for Josh. The data so far has been very intriguing, right? We're looking at CD19 construct for lupus nephritis, and what was really unique is the patients who responded, they stayed in the CR in complete response even when the autoantibody sort of B cells came back. Any explanations to that? And then any thoughts about NK cells and whether they could be effective there too?
Great questions. It's an intriguing signal that the pathogenic B cells seem to be depleted and stay depleted, whereas some of the protective immunity B cell producing cells are preserved. Like you don't see that in CAR T. You don't see in oncology or in transplants. Typically, all that protective immunity that you get from vaccines is essentially wiped out, and patients have to get revaccinated. But in this setting, at least the early data suggests that's not the case. Maybe it's a little bit more mild. Maybe the patient's pathogenic B cells are just different enough from the normal memory B cells that somehow the CAR T is able to differentiate. So definitely something to keep an eye on, and there are aspects to this very similar to the oncology CAR T data that you just can't explain, at least at this point. And then the NK cells, to your point, Your Honor, starting to move in. Announcements from Nkarta and from Fate, and I know some others are contemplating a move as well. I think most investors have been fairly dismissive that the NK cells will be able to match what the CAR T cells are doing, in part because they weren't quite as potent in the oncology setting. So the assumption is that they won't be as potent in the autoimmune setting, but that may or may not be the case. And that's part of the challenge, is that we don't know enough about how these are working, why they're working, what is needed to work in the autoimmune setting compared to the oncology setting. So it's one of the many questions that we'll be looking for answers in the coming months/years ahead.
I thought it was interesting just to show how, like, in vogue the space is now. You know, a few weeks ago, Nkarta, NK company, of course, announced that they were going to have an autoimmune program, and their stock doubled just based off of the announcement. And I think it does go to show, like, especially for NK cells, like the oncology space, like they're still working on it and you know, may succeed, but it's been a tough go. And some of the data here has been incredible. So it does present a new opportunity for a lot of companies like that. Okay, so moving on. So the third conference, which is always a huge one in and of itself, is AASLD. So that's the liver meeting, and this is taking place in Boston this year. So especially with all the companies already in town, I imagine it'll be a pretty lively one. And I think it's interesting that it's going on at the same time as the American Heart Association meeting, because the liver meeting for the last handful of years, like the talk has always been about NASH and whether we're going to crack the code there. And now I think the big, you know, gossip this year is going to be like, what impact are the GLP-1s going to have on the NASH space? So it'll be interesting to see all of that get sorted out. But I know some companies like Viking and 89bio have some NASH data that they'll be presenting. And then some other companies like Pliant, Sema Bay, and others have cholangitis data. Anybody on the panel have any comments on the liver space or NASH specifically? And also just kind of like how it may or may not get disrupted by the weight loss drugs.
I think, Tim, or Brett, how I think of, you know, the impact of the weight loss drugs on NASH is probably more the steatohepatitis side, right, before the fibrosis starts in the prevention of it. I think there's still going to be, which is the tougher nut to crack, right, reducing the fibrosis in the liver due to NASH. I'm not sure if the weight loss can really do that, but it can prevent it from occurring in the first place. So one would wonder, you know, are we going to not see this epidemic of NASH fibrosis as we originally suspected, if as we increase the utilization of these weight loss drugs and change the most important modifiable risk factor for that disease?
I think it's fair to say that the, you know, Don, you're right on, and that the FGF21 class is also at some level focused on sort of the earlier stages, which is one of the reasons we've seen somewhat disappointing data from, say, Akero. Pliant is a completely different story, right? So even though they're going after cholangitis, you know, they're testing a direct antifibrotic, and we really haven't seen a lot of direct antifibrotics get far in the clinic. And so I think it's very exciting to see what they'll be doing.
One other thing to highlight at AASLD is a private company called Replicor out of Quebec, of all places, which is not necessarily a central hub for bioinnovation, but they've got a really interesting program for hepatitis B, which has been a very difficult nut to crack. They're a very unique platform based around oligonucleotide technology, but not in the traditional sense, not kind of the knockdown agent that you see from Ionis and Arrowhead and some others, is actually one of the few agents that looks quite exciting for the field. And it looks like it is able to deliver sustainable HPV cures or cure-like responses. So that's one to flag at AASLD as well, but I don't think is on all radar screens.
Thanks for that. I just want to just give a shout out to Quebec, which actually is a bit of a hotbed of innovation. If you might remember, Inversago, which was acquired by Novo a couple of months back with their weight loss drug, is actually also Quebec based. And there's actually quite an interesting biotech ecosystem in Quebec. So I just couldn't let that go by.
Yeah, and so I'm going to go sort of old school with Josh on back to HPV. So the other drug that's worth flagging is the GSK Ionis ASO, Bepi, that is actually so far been the only drug to show a functional cure on top of a nuke in HPV. It was, you know, kind of low double digits. But that's going to be updated at AASLD. And GSK just announced a collaboration or partnership with J&J for the Arrowhead, a hepatitis B, you know, RNAi-based modality. And it seems like what they're going to end up doing is sort of starting potentially with the RNAi and then following with the ASO to maximize sort of cure and durability. It looks like the RNAi might be faster initially, and the ASO might have a more pleiotropic effect on the immune system, not just through necessarily the direct HBV knockdown, but it's definitely data that's kind of worth following as well.
All right. Well, I think that covers it for the conferences. It's going to be really busy seeing the news, all that news come out. So everybody celebrate. We have an IPO today. That's been a rare thing this year. So this is Cargo Therapeutics. They raised almost $300 million, and it's about $1 billion valuation. So I talked about this a few weeks ago, when they kind of launched this IPO process. So this is a CAR T company, and their lead program is a CD22. So this is for patients who have relapsed on CD19 products who are experienced antigen escape, which is interesting. But I think the thing that's really interesting is further on down the line, they have preclinical programs, one of which targets three different antigens, CD19, CD20, and CD22. And I think it just really goes to show where the CAR T space may be headed. I like to always say the first generation of CAR Ts are kind of like a Swiss Army knife with one tool. And as engineering has gotten better, in the future, they'll have more than one tool. I mean, they already do today, but here you have a company that's coming out with a tri-specific CAR T. So just really goes to show, you know, where cell therapy is headed. And, I have to admit, I'm a little surprised by the valuation. I mean, it's a great company, but you know, cell therapies have been a little bit out of favor lately. But I guess it's a sign of how investors view this particular company and their technology. Tim, I know you follow the financial markets, you know, really closely. What do you think of this? And just you know, you always see like a lot of filings around this time of year. You know, companies like to go public like just before, just after JPM to kind of make a media splash. Like, how do you feel about the capital markets in general and the IPO market specifically?
Great question, Brad. I mean, it's been rough, right? So the capital markets are a reflection of the broader markets. So as we sit here today, as I think we said sort of at the beginning, you know, the XBI marched all the way down this year from like 90 to like 64. And then we had some pretty positive developments at the Fed. The XBI popped right back. And then this week, it's sort of right back where it was. And so it's true, Cargo went public, and that was effectively a pre-wired IPO. In other words, the supporters of Cargo are really very enthusiastic about the story. And so, you know, they've essentially committed to get that IPO done. And that's obviously why you see a very healthy valuation, given the week that we have. I'm not saying Cargo isn't worth it. I'm just saying for this week, that's, you know, pretty impressive valuation to pull off. The question is, where is this all going? And I think we're just not out of the woods on sentiment right now. We need to see sentiment start to turn. I do think that, you know, 2024 will be better, but it's not obvious sort of what specific catalyst will get us there at this point.
Hey, Tim, do you think we're going to see the IPO window essentially forced open with kind of some of these club deals that investors can put together, you know, instead of back to this pseudo private series round, but in the form of an IPO with a very tight placed deal, even if the markets are not warm and receptive?
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly seeing some IPOs that are going to happen. And, you know, like the IPO is kind of like the new word for crossover. And so, you know, the idea of an IPO is to bring in outside investors into your stock. And that's just very hard to do. And most crossover investors are really focused on making sure that the companies that they have, like, get fed. And so you're not seeing as much participation right now from, you know, traditional public only investors in these deals. I'd be very curious, Josh, to hear what you and your own are seeing from your purchase kind of on that topic.
Yeah, I mean, I think despite fairly inhospitable markets, we are starting to see some companies that are not quite as mature as the some of the names that went out in 2023 with a very narrow IPO window kind of being pushed out. And you know, they're certainly not bad names. But there's a little bit of a difference in their maturity status, despite the fact that the markets are just still really challenging. So I do wonder if, you know, there's certainly some great companies that are going to be IPOing in the coming months and quarters ahead that certainly deserve to be public, even in a challenging market. But I suspect that we're going to see the private investors essentially force the door open for some of the companies that others may not view as necessarily mature enough, but they just need some liquidity, and that may be the way to get it.
Yaron, what's your view?
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think we're also, look, I think sadly, and maybe it's a word of caution of something we all know, and validation is worth a lot, but validation also means that you need to be a very fast follower, and you ultimately need to be best in class. And you know, it's very easy to start a company at $50 million, $100 million up front, and the comps are sitting at 800. They should be sitting at 3 billion, and kind of getting yourself to an IPO and hopefully some kind of a return to the initial shareholders. But that company then needs to operationalize itself and be differentiated. And so we're saying, you know, I&I is sort of the next oncology, right? There's validated targets and there's a ton of competition. Those companies are, we're seeing more and more of those, and we are fans of I&I, obviously, but we'll talk later about Ventix. Obviously, the bar is very high. So we're seeing a lot of that. We're spending more time, frankly, on novel companies, a little bit harder for them to get the right valuation before they're validated. But those businesses are to be the ones, those who make it, who are going to be the winners long term. So I think we're seeing a dichotomy of both right now. And a lot of platform, frankly. And a lot going on in ADC, but that's, again, going to be competitive. And then there's a lot going on in radionucleotides, but they're all early stage.
Thanks. It's really helpful.
Somebody, by the way, commented, check your math, Vonkar. It's nowhere near a billion valuation. I haven't looked at it closely. I thought I saw somebody tweet that the other day, so I might be wrong about it. But if they raise 300 million, it's got to at least be in that hemisphere. Moving on. So the I&I space is something we've talked a lot about lately. You know, of course, a couple of weeks ago, you had the Roche, you know, Roivant deal for their TL1A. And, you know, one of the big drugs in this category are TYK2s. So you have the Bristol drug on the market today. I would say, like, we've all seen the commercial with the guy in the Speedo. So I think everyone has learned about this drug class, like, you know, through commercials again. And then you had the big Takeda deal with Nimbus, where they paid $4 billion up front. For that one. And actually Nimbus can still earn a couple more billion based off of the milestones of all of that. So, you know, with that kind of money, you have a lot of companies going after this. And one of them had a blow up this week. So that's Ventix. Who wants to take that one? Josh?
Yeah, happy to jump in. Now, it was a surprising and unfortunate result for the Ventix team. It's a San Diego-based biotech company. Some really wonderful people there. You know, and the data turned out for whatever reason to be not as competitive in the classes as they had hoped for. The stock, not surprisingly, just took quite a beating this week. You know, from my perspective, kudos to them for having the gumption to stop the program and not try to find a way to kick it down the road for eventually later downstream challenges. Never an easy decision to make, especially knowing how much focus this program was for investors. They do have a couple of other programs advancing. They have their TYK2 for Crohn's, so I think expectations for that are fairly limited following some TYK2's data. They have an S1P1 modulator for ulcerative colitis that had an intriguing signal at a data update earlier this quarter in phase 2. I think we're just kind of waiting to see that data set evolve a little bit more and try to figure out if their apparent very strong signal on endoscopic remission, it can be essentially explained by being able to drive lymphocyte counts lower. So that's an important data set point we're looking for early next year. They also have an NLRP3 inhibitor, which is a hot target. They have both a peripheral acting and one that's CNS active as well. So there's still some things going on there, but an unfortunate week for a company with, as I said, so just some really good people in San Diego.
Yeah, I second that too. The company is intriguing, kind of. I think they're trading, you know, below cash or below cash, and just the endoscopic remission for the S1P is actually fairly intriguing and seems differentiated. Exactly, you know, what that means. That's not a primary endpoint; it's a secondary endpoint. And as Josh said, that there's an early pipeline there. I think that the challenge a little bit, and this is sort of tied back to the I&I comment. You know, the S1P class has been disappointing so far. Etrasimod, the Velsipity that just got approved from Pfizer, certainly is going to ought to do better than Zeposia by virtue of a better label, better trial design. But it's been, despite being among the best efficacy and oral, these have been very lackluster, sort of, at least Zeposia has done so far. And then, of course, Sotyktu, you know, both... also a Bristol drug, just like Zeposia, is also off to a very slow launch on the TYK2 side. And, you know, it's getting 40% of new starts right now in psoriasis on the oral side, which is huge. But, of course, most of it is free drug right now, given its pending formulary placement. So I think we're seeing just a lot of challenges on the I&I side. A lot of it's formulary related, and I think it's putting a little bit of a lid on some of the enthusiasm.
I'll make a comment on Ventyx. You know, I was very struck by the company's very straightforward, you know, take. They didn't try to spin their data, right? So many companies, they have like a mixed data set or not great data set, and they spin it. And I think, Josh, you talk about this all the time about, you know, how you present data sets. Ventyx just came out and said, we're not going to continue. Here's our data. They had a full PowerPoint presentation on their website, they went through the data with their investors. They treated their investors like shareholders and partners. Reminded me very much last year when, you know, Third Harmonic had negative data. They just came out and said, hey, these are negative data. We're going to move on. And what is remarkable to me is just how much they were punished for it this week. And I think it's really kind of a comment on the market. On my screen, you know, they're trading at negative $136 million enterprise value, in you know, Josh, your comments about the potential with their S1P, and you know, I'm personally very excited by what they're doing in NLRP3. It's you know, just a very odd situation, and unfortunately, we're seeing that across not just this company. Investors seem to be in kind of a shoot first, ask questions later mindset right now, unfortunately.
In a bearish tape, very hard to get in front of news, but often, you know, there's opportunities after the news is out.
All right. Well, we only have about 10 minutes, and we still have a lot to cover here, so I'll try to push through it. Another company in the I&I space that had a little bit of a setback, at least if the stock is any judge, is MoonLake. So they had a trial announcement in psoriatic arthritis. And this is a company that's doing nanobodies. So they're, you know, developing antibody derived target therapies that are based on small antigen binding variable regions of heavy chain only antibodies. So this particular one is designed to hit IL-17A and IL-17F and also albumin. And, the issue here, like to really dive deeper in this, Adam Feuerstein wrote a really great summary of it in Stat News. So I'd point everybody to that story. The issue here is that they looked at their data both compared to placebo and against a generic drug, adalimumab. And against placebo, everything looked awesome, but against the comparator, not as much. And so it kind of got dinged on that. But you know, it just goes to show that like in a hot space, you're going to have, we're going to see a lot of companies going after it and a lot of data. So we'll have to compare and contrast, you know, pretty closely. Switching topics, I'm going to kick over to you, Yaron, because BioNTech had an R&D day this last week. And, you know, with the way that, like, you know, Pfizer has announced cost cutting because of the, you know, slower vaccine and Paxlovid sales, the vaccine sales, of course, have a big impact on BioNTech. And so just like Moderna, they're kind of getting back to what they were doing before COVID, which is cancer. And it sounds like they tried to lay all of that out this week. How did it go?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there's almost three things to talk about. There's the existing business with COVID. To me, the second most important business potentially is going to be the COVID flu vaccine, and then three, to your point, the oncology proprietary pipeline. On the COVID side, you know, they're struggling, and demand continues to be soft. I mean, I think they're admitting that there's COVID vaccine fatigue. I think what's striking to us is that we thought that at least people who took a flu vaccine are going to get a COVID shot as well. And volumes are probably down relative to that, I would say, by about 50%. I can give you the exact numbers. And I'm not sure exactly how fast that's going to bounce back. So that's one element. I think one of the things they're going to try to do next year also is to really boost and improve their gross margins and lower their COGS. But, you know, COVID is COVID. On the flu side, with Pfizer, it looks like they're getting, with the mRNA vaccine, they're getting good activity against the A strain. They're not quite getting to exactly where they want to be on the B strain. And so they have a little bit of wood to chop there. Some of it might be trial design, and there's just fewer B infections right now. But, of course, you know, with COVID for them, it's a 50-50 deal with Pfizer. On the flu alone, they get, you know, roughly 10% royalty. But the flu COVID combo, we think, is going to be somewhere in the 30% sort of margin. So that could be pretty interesting. And that's getting pushed out a year, but they're going to move to phase three. So that's definitely worth watching. On the oncology side, you know, they have a lot of platforms. I'll tell you what we sort of like. What we like is they're taking a lot of their novel pipeline, which is risky, and now they're marrying it with a much more validated target set. But the concern is twofold. One, they have a huge pipeline, and they can't hire oncology clinical personnel fast enough to operationalize that. So there's an execution risk and timing risk. And then two, a lot of what they're bringing in, while it's cost effective, these are sort of, they're not the first in class targets. They're going to be trying to be fast followers against AstraZeneca and Roche, you know, and Gilead and Merck. So it's going to be a little tough. They're going to try to find sort of carve out these niches in the ADC space, you know, in HER2, or in the CTLA-4 space, but that's going to take a little time. So I'm, you know, the stock's trading at, you know, 1.5x cash right now. It's not expensive. We do like their HSV, their herpes simplex, and their shingles vaccines too with Pfizer, but those are in phase one. So, you know, lots to process there. But, you know, next year is still a little bit of a show me story year for them.
It was interesting that they highlighted some of their AI capabilities the same week that Moderna hosted their event. They really dove into their AI capabilities, including building their own plugin for ChatGPT, which is an area that certainly me and my colleagues feel like we need to much better understand and be able to work with, because the productivity gains in theory are profound, and it's a platform. Whether it's ChatGPT or other, that sounds like it's getting better every day. And so the ability to you know, leverage that for really everything we do could be quite powerful, but it's also, you know, all sorts of subtleties that require a fair amount of training and experience.
Just to make a broad comment, apologies. You know, I thought the BioNTech presentation was just awesome. I mean, it's like, wow, look at all the stuff that this company is doing. Moderna was also very impressive. And, you know, a number of the other earnings presentations were really good. Like, think of, you know, Bristol, if you go through everything they had to say, it was very impressive what the company is doing. And yet the stocks are not doing well at all. I mean, they feel like biotechs, and what's working right now in the stock market are stories where you have a single product with just massive growth. It doesn't have to just be a GLP-1. You know, Keytruda also is doing wonders for Merck. And I do feel like you know, BioNTech specifically, it's like they've got too much going on. The company needs, in some ways, to refine the story. And I think that's in general kind of an issue with the very broad pipelines we're seeing in many pharmas.
Yeah, and Tim, one of the big debates with BioNTech also is they've done all of these licensing deals for non-mRNA things, mostly with Chinese companies. And it's like, you know, next generation CTLA-4, ADCs, and things like that. And I think there also is like a question of, is that smart or not? I don't know the answer, but like, you know, Moderna, for example, has been very adamant of like, we're going to stay focused on mRNA because that's our expertise. And BioNTech seems to be drifting from that. And so, you know, I'm wondering if that's a good thing or not. I guess time will tell.
Look, we're not an industry of platforms, we're an industry of drugs. If the people at BioNTech have insights into a specific target that they think they can pursue, more power to them. The question is, you know, what do they have there? And I actually think they have a lot. It's very hard to pick out of that. Again, just awesome, but lengthy R&D presentation.
All right, moving on. We're running out of time here, and we have a few more things. I'm going to go back to you, Josh. speaking of, you know, companies with like one big product, Neurocrine. So we've talked about Ingrezza for years and years and years. I mean, it's a blockbuster, you know, huge successful product, but they've reached a point over the last couple of years. It's like, what's next? And sadly, they had some failures this week. Tell us about it. Josh, I think you're on mute.
I think he just texted it. His sound is cutting out and he can't hear us.
Oh, okay. I don't know. Yaron, do you follow that Neurocrine by chance? Is that in your coverage? Maybe not.
I follow this very peripherally. I mean, this was a focal onset NaV1.6. Their partner is Xenon, but that was kind of partnered out to Neurocrine and it wasn't core to Xenon. And sadly, the NaV1.6 mechanism has been interesting. There are several channels. One's involved. 1.6 is definitely a hot one. I spent 4 years at a company called Ovid working on epilepsy, so we know a little bit of this target. We don't cover my colleague covers Neurocrine, but the data unfortunately didn't pan out in focal onset. It wasn't exactly clear whether it's a therapeutic window issue or why that was the case, but I think Josh is more suited to speak on it than I am.
All right, no problem. And then lastly, so BioMarin, you know, of course, a couple weeks ago announced the CEO change, and it's going to be hard to think of BioMarin without JJ Bienaimé at the helm. He's been there for, you know, so many years. And this is a company that is at a really important moment. I mean, they have the hemophilia A gene therapy launch going on, and also chondroplasia. And, you know, the announcement a couple of weeks ago was that Alexander Harding, the CEO of Genentech, is going to be taking over. And, you know, that's a really interesting move. A lot of people are talking about that. But this was in the news again this week because Elliott Investments, which is known for, you know, being an activist investor, has reportedly taken $1 billion stake in BioMarin. And so the question is, are they going to pressure the company to like sell themselves? When the CEO change was announced, the stock actually did trade down. And a lot of people have speculated, like Paul Matisse on an interview that I did yesterday, you know, talked a lot about this, how it, you know, likely the reason behind it trading down is if you have a couple year long executive search, like surely you also like considered selling the company or maybe pursued it too. And if that didn't happen in the past, maybe it's a bad sign that it can't happen in the future. But I'm just wondering if anyone has any comments about the Elliott news or just what's going on with BioMarin in general.
I mean, I think Elliott has a pretty good track record with their activism campaigns. Obviously, we now know why JJ Bienaimé left, most likely. Everything I've heard about Alexander Hardy from his colleagues at Genentech is really positive. And so I do hope that the company will have, you know, good things to come. And, you know, for what it's worth, if you look at most of the companies that Elliott has gone after in the past, they haven't been sold. So I think they're an activist that's very focused on operational execution and improvement. So, you know, let's see what that means for us and for the company in the future.
All right. Well, we're already past the top of the hour. Let's close things out. Do any of the panelists have closing remarks?
I was just going to say that on the ChatGPT, I keep on asking it to help me out with my stock picks, because I think they're going to do a better job than we've been doing in this market, but it's declining to provide stock tips. I'm a little disappointed.
Sentiment is just so bad right now, isn't it?
Well, I just wanted to say to that point, Tim, that, you know, there seems to be to me a disconnect between the sentiment and all the innovation that we're seeing. So, you know, I guess what is a good characteristic of you know, biotech veterans is resilience, and we just have to persevere, you know, through this downturn in sentiment, because there's certainly a lot of optimism in terms of innovation.
All right. Before we go, so Daphne will be back next week, and I meant to mention actually at the top of the hour, so Yaron, for the podcast that he does for TD Cowen, was nice enough to interview both Daphne and I at the same time, just talking about like our entrepreneurial journeys. Hers is a lot more impressive than mine, and it was really cool to hear her talk about, like, you know, starting PureTech and like to see what it's become and everything. And I talked about launching Biotech TV. So I've shared that on LinkedIn. If anybody wants to check it out, you know, please do. It's a really great podcast. And I love the fact that Yaron, you know, does things like that. And, you know, that his firm is really focused on social media and putting out like educational material and, you know, highlighting people in our industry. So thanks a lot for that. And then lastly, one small kind of fun little thing I'll mention. So I'm headed to the Bay Area for the rest of the year. And on if anyone is in the Bay Area, on Thursday, Primal Shah, who runs a company called Myome, and I are going to host a very informal biotech meetup at the In-N-Out Burger in Redwood City. So if anyone would like to join us, it's totally unofficial. We're just kind of like meeting there together, and anyone else is welcome to come and talk biotech. So it's going to be Thursday from 6 to 7, and I'll tweet out a few details about that. But otherwise, we'll close things up and look forward to, you know, a lot of data from all these conferences this weekend. Thanks a lot for joining us. Bye.